Okay. So we have quite a number of people here, so let's go ahead and get started. Today we're going to be doing a demo of the reference implementation. I'm up to Scribe. I'm not going to be able to do that today. Greg, would you mind? You're next up in the queue.
Sure, I'll Scribe.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Okay. On the call today, let me go ahead and put our agenda here in the IRC. Agenda. So on the call today, we were hoping to do some introductions to new participants. There are two groups from kind of the Bitcoin Government 2.0 cryptocurrency space that were interested in the identity stuff that we were working on here. They were going to join us on the call today, but I don't see them. We were going to do introductions to them, but we may just skip that. We have the W3C TPAC credentials draft presentation, which has been updated. That we could take a look at very quickly, just so everyone knows what we're going to be presenting at W3C Technical Plenary. And then we'll just launch right into the demo and try to spend as much time on the demo as possible. Any other updates or changes to the agenda? Anything else we should discuss today?
I was just going to mention that I just got back from Las Vegas and I spoke to NACS, the National Association of Convenience Stores, basically about credentials, and had a pretty good attendance for the early morning session, and I was asked about it, and I said, I don't think so, but I think they got that there's something to get, so.
Okay. Okay, so that's NACS show.
It's Henry Story here. I'm implementing signatures. I'll send a longer email to the list, I suppose, later on all the different things that I've come across.
Okay,
but it's too long to discuss.
Thanks, Henry.
Okay. Signatures. Okay. Look forward to that email from you, Henry. We do have a new version of HTTP signatures that we just refreshed the spec. It's the same. Nothing has changed, really. We just made the spec. We refreshed it, meaning that it had expired. It's now not going to expire until April of next year. One of the interesting things is that we didn't think anyone was really paying attention to the spec, but the second it expired, we had a flood of emails from people concerned that we weren't planning to take it forward through the standardization process. So nothing like the threat of something being taken away to get people to pipe up and say that they're that they were actually interested in it. Anything else on the NACS show, Brian?
Just that you have never seen the kind of giveaways like they have on the floor at a store or a show based on convenience stores. Candy, soda, chips, just unbelievable.
Cigarettes, that's the other pillar.
Cigarettes,
of convenience
yeah,
stores,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I avoided it all.
Good. Anything that we should change or any direction and strategy we should change as a result? Did you learn anything that we were doing wrong here or you might want to think about more deeply?
No, just that, I talked to a couple people who, and encouraged them to at least check out the website and the use cases and participate if they had some that weren't being met. So
okay.
we may see some people show up from that.
Okay, great, very great. All right, any other things we should discuss before we launch into the main agenda? And just to check to make sure, let's see, Suzanne, are you on the call today? I forget who, there was somebody else. Was there somebody else that wanted to introduce themselves on the call today?
Hey, Manu, it's Carla, if I can do that.
Sure, yeah, go ahead, Carla.
And I'll just give you a brief overview of the work that's taking place. So some of you may know me from the work that has been taking place with Mozilla and Open Badges and the Badge Alliance, and now I'm working with IMS Global. And I believe everybody's familiar with IMS Global, but just briefly, a nonprofit standards organization that's looking at technical interoperability within the world of education. And the work that I am focused on at IMS is looking at digital credentials and specifically kind of the metadata associated with badges and more even specifically than that, the criteria portion and what are the necessities that we need to do in order to build out the Open Badges standard, what extensions are necessary in order to clearly communicate the value and the import that people believe they're creating as they're creating badges. And digital credentials. And there are three different teams who are working on this initiative, and we're on a kind of a 3 to 6 month time frame. Right now we're about a month in, so we have about 5 months left, and looking at how can we communicate value and from a conceptual framework perspective, and then also the technical interoperabilities that would help us, or technical requirements that would help us get to even greater interoperability. So certainly there's a lot of connections between the W3C work and the IMS work, and then also other connecting credentials work that's being funded by Lumina, as well as Gates-funded work that's taking place at ACE.
Awesome.
Any questions, you can certainly feel free to reach out to me. I know that was a lot, very short time period.
No. That was great. And thank you. Have you been on, I could swear you've been on one of these calls before, Carl, or is that, I'm just imagining?
I have not been on one of these calls before. There are other members of my former team who were probably on these calls, and you and I chatted with Eric Korb at one point.
Okay. All right. That's why I'm getting confused. Thank you, Elton. Thank you for the introduction, Carla. Sorry I missed that. Chris, if you wouldn't mind doing an introduction, that'd be good too.
Hey, so I'm Chris Weber. I am working on the W3C Social Working Group. There's no official connection between this group and that other group at this time, but we are a number of members of us in the group are working on pushing forward in activity streams, JSON-LD-based federation standard for kind of having unified social experience between decentralized sites, and thus obviously figuring out how to do credentials and figuring out how to handle authentication is important, and that's kind of a big open area of the specification that we have. So I've taken interest in figuring out what's going on over here. So I'm looking forward to the demo.
Great, and welcome, Chris. We've chatted a bit on IRC, and delighted to have you here. I think there's a lot of overlap between this and the social web stuff. Okay, anyone else that needs the call? If not, we should definitely jump into the demo because it'll definitely take a good chunk of the hour. Okay, well, welcome everyone that's new. Very quickly, we're prepping for a W3C technical plenary presentation on credentials. We've actually got two of them lined up at the end of October. There is a presentation that has been put together on the credentials work. So the link for that is in IRC. It's a real quick 10-pager. It or 10 slides. It does a pretty good job of hopefully a good job of summarizing the survey that we sent out. The last week we only had around 17 to 20 responses. We're up to 43 out of 60 responses. So we asked 60 to 67 people, and we've got 43 responses. So that's really good turnout. We're getting really good data. We have a pretty strong case as far as, you know, credentials being an important thing that people care about, and people want interoperable standards on that. There is also data on the anonymized results. So I'm going to put the anonymized results in here. Anonymized results of survey, 43 responses. So if you wanted to really dig in to see who responded, what people said. They are anonymized, so any company name I replaced with the word company, any product name I replaced with the word product, and that didn't really detract from the use cases at all. The responses have been randomized, so you can't correlate who said what. We do list the organizations that responded to the survey so that everyone at least knows that they're in good company. And there are a number of graphs starting around questions 7, 8, and 9 that are also in the presentation that underscore the types of capabilities people are looking for, like issuing credentials or requesting credentials or user-centric credentials, portability, things like that. So we've got a lot of updates from last week. We are now the group. We continue to lead among all the groups that are discussing, you know, next generation payments and identity technologies at W3C TPAC. We are leading by a really strong margin as far as feedback from organizations and interest. So that's great. Thank you to everyone who reached out into your network to get people to respond. Any questions on the results of the survey, the anonymized results, or the presentation? Okay, if not, credentials, reference, demo. Okay, if not, let's go ahead and jump into the reference implementation demo. I'm going to put the link in IRC again. It's join.me/digitalbazaar, all one word. We've got 14 people in the demo right now, so let's go ahead and get started. Basically, the demo is going to demonstrate the entire ecosystem, what we have in the specs right now, along with the latest thinking. I'm going to stop around every 10 minutes and ask to see if there are any questions or concerns about what people are seeing. Or if you see something that isn't explained within 3 to 5 minutes, feel free to put yourself on the queue or ask a question if you don't have access to the queue. So let's go ahead and get started. All right, so for those that are new to the call, the credentials ecosystem that we've been talking about for the past year has three major types of actors in it. We've got credential issuers. Those are the organizations that issue credentials. Examples are things like the Department of Motor Vehicles. They issue driver's licenses. We've got U.S. Passport Administration issuing passports. We've got education institutions issuing transcripts or class coursework grades, things of that nature. And many other types of credentials. So that's one of the actors are the issuers. The other set of actors are the organizations that store your credentials on your behalf. So these are called identity providers. We've also called them identity vaults. These organizations are ones that people trust to effectively curate their credentials for them. Just about anyone can become an identity provider in the system. Basically, if you have a long-term access to the web, you can be an identity provider. So you could run your own out of your house if you want to do that. So identity providers are the second group of people in this ecosystem, second group of actors in this ecosystem. And then the third group of actors in the ecosystem are credential consumers. So these are the organizations like LinkedIn or Monster or the HR departments or businesses that ask you to show them your credentials so you can prove that you went to a certain school, you have a certain level of education, you're trained in a particular job, you have access to a particular bank account, things of that nature. So those are the three major actors in the ecosystem. The goal, of course, for this group is to make sure that each one of those actors operates in a level playing field. It's easy to become any one of those things. And it's and interoperability is key. So the credentials that are exchanged between all these actors have to be standardized. They flow over the web, and all of those all of the things that we've been discussing over the past year. The demo we're going to look at today is going to show all three of those actors operating. It is very much focused on W3C TPAC. So the first set of demos we've been asked to focus on payments. This is being discussed in the web payments interest group. They're going to revisit the discussion that we tabled in New York City over the summer to see if the web payments group should get behind the work and potentially help write charters on the credentials, on a credentials working group. So the first demo is a payments specific demo, but hopefully people will be able to see how education and healthcare kind of slots in there. The second demo is kind of a more open free demo. So that happens on Wednesday, and that's the one where we talk about things like education credentials and healthcare credentials and things of that nature. So the demo you'll see today is very much focused on payments because that's the first one that's coming up. We're hoping to maybe add a few things around healthcare and education by the time TPAC rolls around, which is in about 2 weeks. Okay, let me stop there. Are there any questions on the introductory portion of this? Anything that wasn't clear? Did I misspeak or miss anything? Okay, if not, let's go ahead and get started. Really the entry point into this system is creating an account on an identity provider. So these are, identity providers are the organizations that store your credentials. This could be a Google, or like Google Plus or Facebook or Twitter. It could also be your university or college. It could be your high school. It could be a variety of those types of actors. I'm going to go ahead and create an identity here. So pat@hello.com. This process is no different than signing up for like a Facebook account or a Google account. It's the same kind of thing. You're going to some site that you trust, and you're saying that I want to create an account on this system, right? So this is just pretty standard stuff. The part where it starts to deviate from the standard sign-up process is right here. So when I click Create Identity, I'm going to get a pop-up from this site called authorization.io. This is the polyfill that we've been talking about. This is the system that gives you a decentralized identifier. As we've discussed over the past year, when a credential is assigned to someone, we need to assign it to something that is portable. So a decentralized identifier is portable. It's something that you own. It's not something like, for example, an email address that changes over time or a social media address like Twitter or Google Plus. The reason we've chosen decentralized identifiers is because we want this solution to be user-centric. The person should be in charge of their identity and their credentials at all times. And because of that, we can't tie it to a domain that is owned by somebody else, like, for example, a Google or anything like that. You can still store the credentials at Google, but the identifier that the credentials are assigned to or associated with are the persons. The person has full control over it. Any questions on the decentralized identifier stuff? Because this is one of the hardest concepts to get in the entire system. So any questions so far on decentralized identifiers?
I do have a quick comment.
Go ahead, you.
My quick comment was not going to be on decentralized identifiers. It was just going to be to point out that this window that's popped up is part of what would be standardized in the future in the browser.
Yep.
All right. Who is that?
So Sorry, Henry, we missed that.
Say that again.
Who spoke just there?
That was me, Dave Longley.
All right. Okay. So this is what this is what the what do they call that in the web AppSec? That's that you were thinking of. This as the certification.
Yes. This is effectively part of the credential management API.
Okay. And the global identifier, is this a URL or a URI or something? Is that what it is?
It is intended to be a URL with a new scheme, DID.
Uh-huh.
I think you meant URI,
okay.
Right?
Well, it is a location on the web that you can be fetched. So technically, I guess that's classified as a URL.
All right. Well, why is there a need for a new URI scheme?
The reason to invent a new one is to specify a way of doing decentralized identifiers. We couldn't reuse, for example, HTTP or HTTPS because they're not truly decentralized. They're tied to a particular domain, which is tied to the DNS system, which is tied to ICANN. So we're actually looking at trying to create identifiers that people can claim on their own using cryptography instead of having to go through centralized systems and buy domains and things of that nature.
Okay. Usually with that system, you get a problem though. If you lose your private key, then you can't. You have trouble proving that you are that person, right?
Yes, we can talk. We have lots of mitigations for those sorts of problems that we can discuss at some later point.
Yeah, a couple of other points to add to that. One, the system can work with URLs, so you can actually tie credentials to HTTPS URLs. So if you wanted to create an identity that was an HTTPS identity, you could do that. The problem being that if you do not have full control over that URL, which you never do because of ICANN and you know the governments can basically come in and take that URL away from you. But assuming that you're a good honest citizen and your domain's never going to be taken away from you, that is compatible with this mechanism. So you don't have to use DIDs. We just suggest that it's a very good idea for portability reasons. So that's one point. The other point is that, Henry, you raise a very good point, which is what happens when you drop your mobile phone or your laptop in a puddle of water and you lose your private key. The mitigations that we have for that is that you can delegate specific access to this decentralized identifier document to other people or organizations so that even if you lose your private key, you can get two of three signatures, basically M of N signatures, to get other people to be able to update, other people you trust to be able to update your document and insert a new public key in there that's trustworthy. So we do not believe this system suffers from the same problem that, for example, losing a Bitcoin private key suffers from. And there's a number of other mitigations that we have in there, but let's try not to go too deep into that. We can definitely go into that on the mailing list. Chris, you were put yourself on the queue, I believe.
Yeah, so this sounds interesting. I guess, where are these stored and what is actually used to retrieve a DID?
So the right now, let's see. In the future, they're going to be stored on something called a web DHT, so a decentralized hash table that is on the web. It's part of something that we have to standardize. The technology to do that has been used for the past 15 plus years. It's the same thing that powers things like Kazaa and BitTorrent. It's Kademlia-based tables with certain attack mitigations in there. So the technology is well known. We just need to bring that technology onto the web. And rather than creating a completely new protocol and byte stream and protocol and all that kind of stuff, the proposal is to just build it on top of HTTP and HTTPS, basically have a decentralized network built on top of HTTPS on the web. So the way that you, the way it's stored is in a DHT, a Kademlia-based DHT. The way you retrieve it is you use HTTP to hit nodes in that DHT to find the data that you're looking for. So that's effectively how it's stored and how it's retrieved. Today in the polyfill, it's stored on authorization.io. And we have a REST-based API to access it. That REST-based API will continue to be exposed even as this stuff is completely decentralized as we set up the DHT, web DHT and the nodes and all that kind of stuff. Did that make sense, Chris?
Yeah, that sounds really exciting.
Okay.
Just I think this is cool. I think what would be nice would be if one could, I mean, I think the complexity of this is more gives a lot of power to the system. And I think what would be interesting would be, I think in a discussion is to see, as you said earlier, to make sure that we can do this in a way that is completely orthogonal all the way from WebID to this new system, so that, for example, with WebID, we can have onion URIs. This would be just another type of a way of doing WebIDs. I'm also kind of wondering if well, right, so this is kind of interesting, but I think the interesting thing would be to make sure that the HTTP, HTTPS, onion URLs, which allows you to also do cryptography and this, that they all follow the same kind of process so that you can have a complete, so that you, people could choose what type of system they want, and you could have competition for different features. They could be improved. There can be all kinds of new creativity going on there. And I think if the main notion of a web ID is just a reference to a person through which you can get, through dereferencing the document, you can get a description of that person, then it's powerful enough to cover all of these types of cases.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that's in, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no,
what you're saying, Henry, is inherent in the design. We've built this around the idea that it's essentially using the concept of a web ID. There's a URL that you follow to get more information about a particular person, and that all of the credentials in the system are linked to that particular URL. What we're just demonstrating today is there's this concept of decentralized identities that you can choose to associate, that you can choose as your identifier, so that your credentials can be associated with that decentralized identifier and follow you around instead of being tied to a particular domain. So I think your points are salient. They make sense, and we support using any kind of URL here, but we're demonstrating the concept of a decentralized identity.
Okay, so with that said, we haven't even gotten into the demo, and we only have 30 minutes left. So let's try to get through there. I think I don't think there's any disagreement on wanting to support as many different type of lookup mechanisms as possible. But as Dave Longley said, we're proposing what we think is the ideal now with what this group is trying to accomplish. But we have to, of course, make sure that whatever we propose is open to other solutions, right? Other lookup mechanisms and things of that nature. Okay, so with that said, what I'm doing here is I'm generating a new decentralized identifier. And what that's going to do is it's going to generate a new public-private key pair, which is effectively stored in the browser in local storage for authorization.io. That public-private key pair is what I'm going to use to authenticate myself across the web. So I'm going to register a DID here, and there's going to do some crunching and generate a public-private key pair for me and register it in the decentralized hash table. It returns that decentralized identifier back to my identity provider, and my account is created. So this is, I'm at an identity provider here. The account has been created. A decentralized identifier has been associated with that account, and now I can go out and start getting credentials. Okay, so first step is done. I have created an account at an identity provider, and I have a decentralized identifier. Now I'm going to go to another site, which is a credential issuer. So this credential issuer requires me to log in because it needs to know who I am. But the thing that I'm going to use to log in is my decentralized identifier. So I'm going to basically do a cryptographic proof here so that I can log in. So I'm going to log in as Pat Doe. So I'm going to log in here. And basically, that was the whole login process. So let me kind of show that again. The idea here is that you can use cryptography and your decentralized identifier to log into a website. I click login. I select the identity that I want to log in as. And if you look in the background here, I'm not had to navigate away from the window here. When I click this, I will be logged in and ready to receive credentials. So I click it, and I'm logged in. Right. The next thing that I need to do is, of course, so now the site knows my decentralized identifier. Let's say I want a driver's license, so I click on the driver's license. This is, of course, demo code, but this is what the credential actually looks like. This is JSON-LD data. The credential has a set of claims that are tied to an identifier. This is what a decentralized identifier looks like. So it starts with DID colon, and then it's basically a UUID, universal ID after it. And then it's got a set of claims that are associated with it. So the claims are that this is my name, I've got an image associated with me, it's my birth date, gender, height, eye color, this is the address that Pat Doe lives at. This is their motor vehicle license information. So the state of Virginia in the United States issued the credential. It was issued on this date. It expires on this date. Required to wear corrective lenses. I'm only allowed to drive non-commercial automobiles. So that's basically the information that was given to this person, Pat Doe. By the Department of Motor Vehicles, and then there's a signature at the end claiming made by the Department of Motor Vehicles that proves that they're the ones that are saying these things about me and I'm not just making a self-claim. So basically, this issuer says, do you want this credential? Do you want this driver's license? And I say, yes, I do. I click accept, and then it goes back through authorization.io to send me to my identity provider. Remember that there can be thousands of different identity providers, and this site back here has no idea who my identity provider is. That's up to this browser middleware here. Right today, it's the polyfill. In time, it's going to be native browser code to redirect me back to my identity provider with the credential that was issued to me by this issuer, right? And if I scroll down here, This is the credential that I'm going to be storing at my identity provider, right? It's the same data that we looked at this site. And so once I say, yes, I want to store this at my identity provider, the middleware jumps back in and says, it sends the response back to this site and says that the data has been stored. So this issuer had no idea really, it didn't care about where I actually stored the information. It just cares that it was stored and it gets an acknowledgement of that. And this is important because if you have PII, any kind of personally identifiable information, once your customer has stored that credential somewhere else, you have the option of destroying all records, all PII associated with that person so that you're not an attack target for a lot of this personally identifiable information. So that's an example of basically getting a driver's license issued to you and it being stored at your identity provider. Okay, so any questions about the issuance of a credential, how it's generated, how it's stored, anything along those lines? Is it fairly straightforward? Do people understand kind of, or is it?
Or is it?
I suppose the easiest way is just to try again, right? I'm going to try. I had to go quickly, so I might have missed something because someone called. But I think I followed it. You go to the driver's license to the DMV, and they sign. You log in with your ID, right, or something, because they need to know what your ID is.
Yep.
Or somehow they find out what your ID is, and they sign a document saying that the person who has the private key of this, so this is a document that is signed by the DMV with some pointer to a private public key, and it says that any person who has this public key has all of these properties too, right?
At a high level.
And then they give it to you. Your browser takes it, and your browser does something with it, right? And then it might store it somewhere else, or it might just store it in the browser, right?
Correct. Yeah, you might store it at a third party identity provider, or the browser might just store it locally in the browser.
And then when you go log in somewhere, or when someone asks you for your driver's license because you're driving a virtual car and you need a driver's license to drive it, you can send that out.
Right. So let's do that part of the process now. So you're right, Henry. That's basically how it works. Now we're going to go to a credential consumer. Right. So this is a credential consumer. I'm going to use my driver's license to open a bank account. So one of the things when you go and open a bank account, they need to do what's called a know your customer process on you. They need to make sure that you are who you say you are. So if I've got a bank account application form in front of me, one of the ways that they could pre-fill a lot of this information is for me to submit a driver's license. But when I submit this driver's license, it's better than a plastic card driver's license, because there's going to be a digital signature on there. So you're not depending on the teller at the bank to be able to determine if that's a fraudulent document or not. The systems have a way of cryptographically verifying the driver's license. So I'm gonna go here and apply for a bank account. So I'm at a credential consumer. I'm gonna click submit driver's license. It's going to take me back to this middleware, this stuff that's built in the browser. I'm going to select the identity that I want to submit the driver's license. So I'm going to select my identity. I might have multiple driver's license. I might have an international identity and a national identity. So I click this identity, and that takes me to my identity provider. And my identity provider basically says someone has asked for a motor vehicle license. Right, the identity provider has no idea who's asking for it, nor should they know. Right, this is the privacy aware part of it. The IDP, the identity provider, has no idea who you're giving your credentials to. If it knew that, it could track you and do all kinds of, it could effectively violate your privacy without you necessarily knowing that it's doing that. So, the IDP basically gets this request in saying that someone has asked for a motor vehicle license. I click on my motor vehicle licenses, and I'm able to select the motor vehicle license here. So I click on that one. I've selected that I want to send this motor vehicle license on. Here's my name, image, date of birth, gender, height, street address, document ID, right? And all of that, that has, cryptographically verifiable data. The receiver of this driver's license can check, can verify that it came from the Department of Motor Vehicles instead of it just being, made up information that the person's sending. So I say, I want to send this driver's license back. I click done. The browser takes over and takes that credential and asks me one last time, are you sure you want to send this credential over to this site over here, this banking site over here? And if I'm sure I want to send all my driver's license information over here, I click send credentials. Now remember, keep an eye on this screen. I'm on step one of three right now, but the second I hit this button to say that I want to send the credentials to this banking site, it's going to jump to step two of three, because it will have taken my credential, verified its validity, and jumped on to the next step because I've proven at least some part of my identity to this organization. So I click send credentials, and now I'm on step 2 of 3, and it's asking me the next set of information to sign up for a bank account. So that's the credential consumption side of it. That's how you get a credential from your identity provider to a credential consumer. And we have a couple more demos here, basically a loyalty card demo that shows you how you can shop using a loyalty card, a passport demo showing how you can use a digital passport to buy an airline ticket. Clearly, we'll also have demos here for things like student IDs and classes that you've taken, job training, professional licenses that you've had, things of that nature. Okay, so that's the last part of the ecosystem. That's the consumer that's consuming these credentials. At this point, we can go through some of the other demos. So there are a couple of other...
Mato, I had a question.
Sure, go ahead.
So once the bank retrieves the credential, is what steps does it need to do to guarantee the validity of that credential? Is there anything that's not contained within the credential itself that it needs to verify? Does it have any connection back to the issuer or the IDP? Or how does it? Certainly, there's some information to know that the information that's in there is consistent with the picture, but how does it know that it was issued by someone that it can trust?
Right. So the first step is just basic syntactic, you know, checking. The credential has to be, the syntax of the credential has to be correct. It then checks the digital signature to see if the digital signature is valid. So all signatures in linked data signatures point to a public key that's accessible via the web or through the decentralized DHT, the web DHT. So it fetches the public key and checks to make sure that the public key matches there, right? And so remember, we used our public-private key pair to log into the website, so we can check that at some point. But the thing that's really important here, it checks to make sure that the issuer's signature is valid. But that still raises the question on whether or not the issuer itself can be trusted. Like, for example, this banking site would need to trust at some point the Virginia Department of Motor Vehicles. It is up to receivers of these credentials to choose the organizations that they trust. So, for example, for an international driver's license, the United States might trust its allies, and China might trust its allies, but the U.S. might not trust a Chinese-signed driver's license, and vice versa. Right. So it's up to the receiving side of the credential to decide who they trust. And the assumption here is that they will have a list of organizations that they accept digital signatures from. And if you're not on that list, that credential won't be good enough. So there's basically a trust list that the organization has, and the organization gets to decide who they trust. And then after that, there can be deeper verification on the data. So, for example, there could be a link back. There is definitely a link back to an issuer for the credential that says whether or not the credential has been revoked. So you need to check whether or not the credential has been revoked by the issuer. But there is no necessary link back to the identity provider. So at the most basic level, those are the basic checks that need to be done to verify that a credential is valid or not. You check the signature, you check it for syntax, you check the signature to make sure it's valid, and then you check to see if you trust that signature or not. And then, of course, the last thing is that the credential is countersigned by the holder of the credential to the bank. So whenever, you know, Pat Doe sent her driver's license to open a new bank account, there were two signatures on there. One of them was from the issuer, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the second signature was from Pat saying that she authorizes the transmission of that credential to a specific banking site to, one, prove that she's the owner of that decentralized identifier and the true holder of that credential, cryptographically verify that, and two, to make sure that whoever she sends that credential to can't replay the credential, can't do a replay attack against her, and replay that credential to another website. Did that answer your question, Greg, at least at a high level?
Yeah, so the key thing is that the it's the identity provider who is completely out of the loop. They are holding the credentials for me as a convenience, and at the point I signed it and send it to an issuer, the only person that to whom this credential has been used is revealed is the issuer itself.
That is correct.
Okay, yep, that's clear.
Okay. Any other questions on the process or nuances in the process?
I suppose there's the question of if there's a way for the issuer, for the what they call the lying party, but you call something else.
The consumer.
The shopping center of the bank who wants the credentials. If they can say which kinds of credentials they accept, so who they trust, so the client doesn't have to try out 50 different credentials.
Yeah, that's an option. That's an option we're considering including in the query that the consumer makes. So when a consumer makes a query for a credential, they specify either the type of credential they want or the attributes that they would like to learn about a particular identity. One of the things that we're considering including in there is that they could also specify issuers that they trust. There are privacy leak information. There are privacy concerns with that approach, so it's something we're considering and we're looking into for potential solutions.
And then John, you're on the queue.
Yeah. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Good. The machinery for this I understand much better now than I have in the past. This has really been helpful. But one thing that I still find difficult to visualize and to explain to other people are the workflows among these three parties. And one little sub comment is this might be very amenable to another one of your little flip book shows with the little mice and things in it. But because I think that the actual flow of things, since there are three things that you have to assume, now pretend you're an issuer, now you pretend you're an identity provider. So if I could just take one simple use case. Let's say that I have a credential that's based on something that you said in an earlier meeting, that you might have a credential that just says you're 21 or something like that. That's all that it reveals about me. And I have my phone, I walk in and I order a drink, and if I use my wallet, I open it up and show them that they would believe me, they would know that I was 21. But what would that look like in this configuration?
If
electronically.
That raises a couple of interesting points, right? So let me try and figure out which order to tackle these in. So there's a privacy component to your question, right? For example, you don't really want to reveal anything else about yourself other than you're over the age of 21. So the privacy thing here is to see if there's a way of doing that really without exposing any information about yourself other than you're over the age of 21, not even exposing your decentralized identifier to that organization. So let's take the case of you're buying a case of wine at an online wine store. To get that credential in the first place, let's say you go into the Department of Motor Vehicles, you go into some kind of government institution or the U.S. Passport Office. They're going to go through an identity proofing process when you go there, right? They're going to ask you for your social security card and look that up. They're going to maybe ask for a utility bill, a variety of information to basically do identity proofing on you on the spot. And then they may issue multiple credentials to you. They may, like for example, the U.S. Passport Agency may issue you a full U.S. passport with all the information in there. And along with that, they may also issue you a credential that says you're just over the age of 21, right? And that's all that credential does. So whenever somebody asks you to prove that you're over the age of 21, you can just show them the over the age of 21 credential. You don't have to expose your birth date. You don't have to expose your actual age. It's just you're over the age of 21. So there's one credential there that could tie to your DID that you could give someone online to verify that you're over the age of 21. There's another approach that we've been looking at that is hopefully a truly anonymous mechanism called a bearer credential. And bearer credentials are short-lived credentials issued by an issuer to prove something in a pseudo-anonymous fashion. So, for example, the bearer credential is not associated with a DID. It just says whoever holds this credential in the next 5 minutes is over the age of 21. Right, and you can take that credential and give it to the online wine store, and that might meet their minimum requirement, their minimum regulatory requirement for selling liquor to you. Right, they've got a statement from the U.S. government saying that the person that has presented this to them is over the age of 21. So that's the other thing. So there are two points that scenario raises, John. One is a privacy implication. Can we do this without and making it as anonymous as possible? Two, you know, there's this concept of a bearer credential. Three, there's this concept that when you get a credential issued to you, you may get multiple credentials issued to you, some of them more atomic than the other ones. Is that I didn't go through a flow, but is each one of those concepts at least clear to you, John? And then
yep.
I can go through the flow again.
Yeah, no, that's
the flow,
great.
Flow,
Mato,
flow
I'm going to need
to
drop off the top of the hour.
Okay, all right, thanks, Greg. If someone else could take over for Greg scribing, that'd be great for those that want to hang on. Thanks, Dave. Okay. Any other questions on this one? I think Tim has a question here. Does a mechanism exist that discourages groups from demanding more information from a credential than is required for legal purposes? No, you know, if somebody asked you, well, yes and no. So the way that the system works right now is you query the credential consumer queries for a set of attributes that they need to know about you. So if all they need to know is, for example, your name, the query is just name, right? And then you go back to your identity provider, and your identity provider says, you've got 5 out of 20 of your credentials that can prove your name. Which one do you want to use? And what we're hoping is that the interfaces, software interfaces, and the people will understand that they don't need to actually hand over their entire driver's license to prove their name. They may have another credential, like a library card, that proves that just the same. So there is no explicit mechanism that discourages a group from collecting too much information. Because anyone can ask you for anything. It's up to you to figure out whether or not you actually want to give over all that information or not. Hopefully that makes sense, Tim. Type in IRC if it doesn't. Eric, you're on the queue, and then Carla. Go ahead, Eric.
I'm on a train, so I don't know how good this sounds. So if it is, I'll text it.
No, just fine. It's fine.
Okay, thank you. So the question I have is a privacy question. As a best practice, I suspect that we would not want people to publish credentials on a public website that contain their DID. Is that's a question.
Correct.
More than a statement. because if it did, then they could be tracked right back. So I publish a credential that says, this is my driver's license on LinkedIn. I would not want my bid to be revealed there, because then they could track my identity on LinkedIn to every bid that's ever out there. Is that, am I following that right?
Maybe. So it depends on how private you want that identity to be. Right. It depends on how private you want that identity to be. Many people may be okay with their LinkedIn identity being as public as possible. Right. They're saying, this is my DID. Here are all my professional credentials. This is my professional identifier. I'm really not trying to hide anything with it. In fact, I want it to be public. And so publishing your DID along with all your credentials publicly is not a bad thing. Right. But there may be other things that you have to do that require you to hold on. There are other things that may require you to keep that identity hidden in some way, right? So, for example, if you like your healthcare records would be a great example of this. Your healthcare DID and your healthcare credentials, you would probably never want to make public in any way. It depends question, and I don't think that there's a clear answer for it, unfortunately, Eric. And I think it follows kind of the practices that people follow today, right? There are certain parts of your identity that you don't want public and certain parts that you do. And there's some credentials that you're okay with making public, and there's some credentials that you don't want to make public. Hopefully that made sense. Carla, you're next on the queue.
Hey, Manu, you answered kind of answered a few of the questions that I had. Specifically, one was about atomic level credentials, right? Being able, because you mentioned earlier, if you were supplying something coming from your driver's license, perhaps you don't need everything from your driver's license in order to submit or for that identity provider to be comfortable with what it is you've provided. So then that leads me to another question, which is, and you mentioned this, and I'm a little fuzzy on it. So your provider is essentially saying, here are, let's say, five different credentials that currently fit what's being requested of you. Is there a way, so I'm just starting to wonder about the owner of those credentials, right, the person that's representing. Is there a way that we're thinking about how they juggle that and whether or not there might be, I know it's a little early, but like a recommendation engine or that repeatedly used or often used credentials that suit this, or is that completely outside the purview right now?
No, that's very much so. We definitely have to consider that. The idea here is that, you know, there's a competitive marketplace for identity providers, and one of the differentiating factors for an identity provider may be how well they help you select the proper credential to use, right? So some identity providers might be very pro-privacy, and the suggestion that they make is, this is the credential that you could share that exposes the least amount of information about you. So why don't you use that? Or other identity providers might say, you know what, you've been using your driver's license all over the internet. Why don't you just continue to use that? We'll automatically make the selection for you the next time you come back here, right? So I think that's very much in scope for something that an identity provider needs to consider. And how one identity provider differentiates themselves from another identity provider is in how they help the person make that decision. Did that answer your question?
Yep, that was great. Thanks.
Okay, and then Henry, you're on the queue.
So I would just say that by default, the credentials are private. It's only when someone elects to make them public through their IDP functionality would they be exposed. Similar to what you do with a backpack today, right? You make public versions of your badges versus those that you don't publish. So it's the same concept. But they're private by default.
Yes. Yep. Henry.
What I was thinking of is, I suppose one reason for integrating the IDP in the browser, or is that if you authenticate to one site with three different credentials, then in fact you've given all of the, they can do an addition of credentials and they get the sum of that information, right? So if the IDP doesn't know where you're connecting to with the credentials, it won't be able to give you information about how much information you're giving to one site. So that seems to me like, and that seems to me like, in any case, you're going to need that type of thinking for automated robots fetching information for you, because you, a lot of this is here assuming that you want to do it by hand. But at some point, you also, of course, want robots to fetch information, update things for you, authenticate to different sites with different credentials, because you don't want to be doing all the work, right? So that was one kind of thought remark. I suppose also on the other side, imagine you had different identifiers, ID identifiers for one for your age, another one for your driver's license, another one for your membership of a Go club. I suppose what you could do is have other credentials that identify those those identifiers too, right? So that if you could have as many credentials as you have identifiers, you have credentials, and then have other credentials that are our same as relations between these credentials, between the identifiers and the credentials.
Yes, you could certainly do that. I mean, you know, this is all based on linked data, open world assumption. So composability is a big thing here, in general. So nothing that you said is impossible to do with the setup. Yes, we definitely want to automate these processes as much as possible and have agents making decisions for you. And so we've also thought about that. But fundamentally, we have to get the foundation in place before we can kind of go there. But that's very much been on all of our minds as we've tried to build this technology out. Let's see. Tim has been on the.
I've got a quick response to Henry just before we go off topic. I just wanted to say that there are other protocols out there, other technologies that don't fully provide all the features that we need for credentials, and they also have a few drawbacks. For some of these other protocols, the way that the protocol is designed requires the identity provider to always know all of the sites that you are logging into and sending information to. And we wanted this protocol to make that optional. So you can still, in this protocol, reveal to your identity provider who certain consumers are, but you don't have to do that. It's not a requirement for the protocol to function properly. And that's something we wanted to put in there that's privacy enhancing. But if you want to reveal that information to your IDP, you could certainly do that if they're going to give you certain features and you're okay with that.
I suppose, especially if you're your own IDP, right? Then you don't care.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Tim, you have a series of questions that you've typed in here. I'm going to try to read them out. Let's see. Your first statement was perhaps use ontologies to describe what might be required to fulfill particular requests. We kind of do that today, but the requests themselves for information are linked data, so we can extend those requests in arbitrary ways in the future as use cases require it to happen. But for right now, the query is a attribute-based query, so name, birth date, where you went to school, are you a doctor, licensed doctor or nurse, things of that nature. Next question was, if an adult website or online game that may simply require name or proof of age requests more information for, say, free credits, perhaps reputation plays a role. Yes, absolutely. You could have reputation-based credentials. Next question, I imagine part of this is beyond the scope of the credential spec, yet support for ontological functional adaptation may need to be included. I don't know what you mean by ontological functional adaptation. But we could follow it up on the mailing list. You're saying, and then you say privacy by default for the entire credential or for elements of the credential, is it all or nothing? When it comes to a credential itself, it's all or nothing. The reason being that that entire, all the data in that credential is digitally signed, so you can't share the information piecemeal. What we think we can do is ask issuers to atomize the information as much as possible, because then you can compose these things together. If they don't do that, you can't compose the information together. So it is an all or nothing when it comes down to the credential itself, but there's nothing saying that credentials can't be very, very atomic and only keep one attribute, like, for example, name or birth date. Has any consideration been made into reputation? Yes, we have considered reputation, and there's nothing. The only thing that's required is for somebody to come up with a reputation ontology and to start publishing credentials on that reputation ontology. Okay. All right. So I think those are all of the questions that you had in there. We are well past the hour. I don't think there's anyone on the queue left. Are there any other questions?
Any other questions before?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I suppose because I'm doing HTTP signature right now. In some sense, when you're sending a signature with HTTP, has it got anything to do with this? Is this orthogonal? Because you're signing headers. Each header could be thought of as well. Anyway, I'm just wondering what the relation is there.
HTTP signatures, by and large, are designed to give you access to systems. So they're meant for agents, like web agents, machines. So HTTP signatures is primarily intended for machines to be able to access websites. The key identifiers that they use usually live on the web.
I can quickly answer that. So the flow that we showed today was a browser-based API. Everything goes directly to the browser. In the future, in your IDP, you might create like an access control list that gives automatic access to certain credentials for certain consumers, or you might give automatic access to allow issuers to push new credentials to your IDP. And in those sorts of systems where you've given pre-authorization, issuers and consumers could use HTTP signatures to authenticate with your IDP and push credentials in or pull them out.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Okay,
yes,
good.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, so with that said, we're 14 minutes past the hour. Any other questions, send to the mailing list, and we'll try to follow up on the mailing list. Hopefully this was helpful to everyone. To kind of see this demo and understand the flow and where we are today. We're going to be giving this demo at W3C TPAC. So if you want to see changes in the demo, or if something wasn't clear, or you feel like there was something better that we could demo, please let us know. We've only got 2 weeks to clean it up before we show it to everyone at TPAC. Okay, thanks everyone for the call today. We will meet again next Tuesday to prep to go over the TPAC presentations. Thanks everyone for the call and joining, and I hope you have a great rest of the week. See you next Tuesday. Bye.
See you next Tuesday. Bye.
Thank you.